gonna take a lot of love to change the way things are. It's gonna take a lot of love.
Know my heart in my, and welcome to the Caravan of Hope, promoting peace, safety, and well-being for every person on earth, with me, Brent Caldwell.
And me, COVID O'Matic.
And this week, we are going to be joined by Alison Phipps, who is our very special guest coming to us live from Glasgow, where I understand it is a bit late in the evening. It's a bit dark and a bit cold. Alison, we'll get you to introduce yourself in a moment, but we'll just remind our viewers that we are coming to you from Aotearoa, Dunedin, in the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And we're looking forward to the next wee while to have this conversation with you, Alison. So maybe just by way of introduction, Alison, you can tell us a wee bit about yourself and where you are to this point.
Yeah, kia ora, tēnā koutou katoa. It's lovely to be speaking to you in Aotearoa, Dunedin again. I have such fond memories of my time there. But yeah, I'm coming to you from Glasgow. I'm looking out over the Campsie Fells, or I would be should I be able to see them. At the moment, there's really quite a lot of darkness and cloud, and I'm about, 300 yards from the Clyde River. The one that took ships and settlers all over the world, but also the one that brought in tobacco and sugar from the slave plantations. So a kind of fraught river, really. And I'm in my home at the moment. I think my husband's in the background, and settling in after a long day at work, and really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thank you very much for being so generous with your time, and we look forward to what we're going to learn. So, COVIDO, I'm going to hand over to you.
Okay. Wondering if you could tell us about yourself and your upbringing, and maybe who were the important people in your life?
Yeah, so at the moment, the most important marker of my identity is that I'm a grandmother. I have three absolutely beautiful grandchildren, and quite an exciting family, and that it's quite a mixed up family of Eritreans and then ourselves living here in Scotland. But I grew up in Sheffield in South Yorkshire. According to my mum and dad, the border moved between Derbyshire and Yorkshire about a month before I was born, which my mum was really excited about, because it meant that had I been a boy, I could have played cricket for Yorkshire. So go figure. I'm a Yorkshire lass. I grew up in Yorkshire, in Sheffield. And I grew up there during the time when the steelworks were closing and the mines were closing, when Margaret Thatcher was prime minister. Mm-hmm. I grew up at a time when the film by Barry Hines, Threads, about nuclear apocalypse, was being filmed in my city. And we were all asked to be extras as school children and to literally be evaporated in the middle of the city, and they drew round us in chalk and then got us to stand up or use spray paint. I can't quite remember. So those were quite formative experiences, you know. So, you know, Margaret Thatcher was a big figure in my life, but really as a bit of a demon, because she was responsible for a lot of misery in the city. And in my school was a school that really suffered the worst excesses of unemployment and deprivation. So at that time, it went from being a place where people were in full employment to no employment, where the youth had no prospect of employment in the city. And so I really watched the suicide rates in my school and in my classes go through the roof. It was like an aeroplane effect. So every year we would lose somebody to quite violent suicide, as young people do when they have no hope. So I think all of that was kind of part of my political formation in many ways. And then I think I've told this story before in many places, but my grandparents were I think about this in terms of the pepeha, really, but my grandparents were really key figures in my life. My grandparents on my father's side were butchers, and they fed the village. They grew up, they worked, they had a little butcher shop in Lincolnshire on the east coast in the Fens. And my grandfather had a van and did the rounds, and he would be constantly feeding the village and, picking people up off the floor or from farming accidents, or lending out the family silver and crockery so people could cook their turkey. And so there was a real
Wow.
kind of provisioning the village on that side of the family. And and I would help with slaughtering the pigs and the sheep and the cows when I was tiny, like 5, 6, 7 years old. I have those memories. And then on the other side, my grandfather was the personnel officer for British Northrop, which was a loom manufacturing firm that made the looms that spun the cotton that came from the Indian subcontinent as part of the colonial endeavors of the British Empire. And after the Second World War, when there was a great shortage of labor because we'd killed all the young men, many people came from the Indian subcontinent who were employed in British Northrop, and my grandfather was the first person that they met. And he was really taken. These are the stories in the family. He was really taken by the fact that he didn't that these were people who'd not been welcomed properly. And I think out of his, nonconformist church tradition, he was like, these people need to come for Sunday lunch. And so there would be a bit of a tradition of hospitality in the family with my grandmother. And so they got to know people from the new arrivals in Blackburn in Lancashire, and then the refugees from the Prague Spring and from East Germany through the
Wow.
Cold War. And so there was a bit of a story of welcoming refugees or welcoming people from overseas. And these people stayed in touch with my grandfather often if they went back, and he had a stamp collection, and all of the stamps were relationships from around the world. And it wasn't like worth anything, but it was so valuable to him. And as grandkids, we'd pore over this like empire collection where he'd been kind of almost replacing empire with relationships and love lines. And I remember when my grandfather died, people came out of the shops, which are now owned by Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus from the Indian subcontinent, and stood and lined the road and paid their respects as we drove past with the hearse. And that was really moving. And people wrote, I remember one of the people from the Prague Spring who'd known the family well, he'd always written to my grandfather at Christmas, and now he wrote to my mum, and that's continued and been part of the story in the family. So I think those stories of work with refugees were really important to me, and my grandparents were really formative in that experience, as were my parents, who were teachers and wanted me to value education and wanted me to have a degree of independence, I think, and go out and explore the world. Maybe alongside that, my language teachers, who I think Sheffield was such a difficult place to grow up at that time, where hope was just leeching out of the city, that I found in languages an escape that I couldn't have imagined. And I found when I first traveled abroad, wow, there's like a whole world out there, and it's amazing and it's different and it's exciting. And through languages, I might make a different sense of it to the one that's being made for me by a what I was experiencing as a very repressive and hope removing government at the time. So, yeah, I think those would be the important people to me.
Oh, that's lovely. I felt very touched to hearing about your grandfather. Yeah, beautiful story.
So then,
Yeah.
you've said about your upbringing, and then into how languages kind of opened up the world. Following on or standing on the shoulders of your grandparents and your parents. Where did that take you to, Alison?
Yeah, so to start with, well, the languages we were allowed to learn in school were French and German, and that was all part of the Entente Cordiale, De Gaulle rebuilding the peace initiative with Europe. And because Sheffield was also the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire at the time, a few people were allowed to learn Russian, but you had to go to the posh school to be able to do that. And I didn't. So French and German were the languages. And so they took me to France and Germany on school exchanges. So I got to know, and I'm still in touch with my German pen friend from that time, all these years later. Her daughter's friends with my daughter. We've still got a lovely connection and lovely stories that I can tell maybe later in what we talk about. But and I loved it. I loved the experience. So I went on to study French and German. They took me to university, and I did a straight languages degree with literature. And enjoyed it, but kind of didn't really want to spend my life in a literary world. I love literature and I love poetry and particularly drama, but I was really wanting the life of the languages. And I then did my PhD partly in Germany, really wanting to study how communities in southern Germany, where there'd been a great displacement after the Second World War, had come to rebuild their lives and find a way of integrating as new communities together. So those which were often, former highly conservative, often very much signed up to the National Socialist endeavor, how they had welcomed the refugees from the East, how they'd rebuilt, how they'd brought people back in, and how they dealt with the shame of what National Socialism had represented, and how the arts had been part of enabling that to happen. So what the role of arts was in refugee integration, in peace building, in hospitality, in drama, in creating new forms of drama, in producing drama when there weren't many buildings in which to do it. So looking at open air theatre was really what I did, and I always ever intrepid, I kind of didn't want to just study it as text. So I went and acted in these plays in a highly impenetrable dialect of German called Swabian, which doesn't really sound much like German at all. But I happened to have been able to learn some of it through my love of Germany and my time in Germany. So I went and acted in the plays and learned my lines in Swabian and dressed up in funny costumes and was part of performing to audiences of about 2,000 people every weekend. Obviously not in a leading role. I was one of the I was part of the chorus and the crowd, but really found it a great way of studying, that the lived experience of life and the way of studying that means that you are doing work in such a way that you feel all of it. You get wet when it rains, and I would notice if I'd put a tiny bit of weight on every week in one of the theatres because the boned corset that I had to wear wouldn't quite fit. And yeah, so that was part of the experience, and that's where it took me. And I suppose that training, if you like, in anthropology and ethnography and participant observation, in comparative study, and in thinking through these different intersecting layers of culture and heritage and tourism and refugee experience. And this was all happening to me just after the wall had come down. So the Berlin Wall was changing the nature and shape of Germany yet again. Then this was a really fertile ground for thinking with. And I think now I can look back, 30 years on and think, wow, that was really quite a heady time. But I was young and I had an Interrail card and I could travel Europe and the borders were opening and we could cross into the East for the first time and I could make friends. And this was a really exciting time of life, to be saving your pennies and traveling the world.
So did that change your compass in terms of where you thought your life was going to go and what your academic life and your work were to become?
I never had a plan, and I never really had a plan. I loved to teach, and I'd really already thought, well, I'll probably end up teaching in schools. I really love working with young people. That's probably what I'll do. I'd always done voluntary work with young people, be it through Scouts and Guides or various different organizations, both in France and Germany when I'd lived there, but also elsewhere. But I think I'd got a bit of a kind of bug for understanding these forms of theatre in Germany that I'd encountered by chance. I'd got lost when I was doing a youth camp, and we were supposed to go to one of these open air theatres at night. And because I got lost, I didn't get there. We missed the performance. And so for several years, this just nagged. I was like, this was a really cool thing, and I really wish I'd done it. So I ended up writing a proposal to do a PhD and getting funding, and that's what I did. So I made good on getting lost. But in many ways, that's a little bit of the story of, it's not so much I had a plan, it was just each step I took me to another step. And I wanted to do work that was meaningful and interesting, but I didn't really have a kind of sense of where I'd end up. And I can look back on it and spin doctor and kind of script doctor a story, if you like. But really, I think, those themes that were laid down by my grandparents and in my school, of kind of both wanting to be in a place where the work would be meaningful and interesting and exciting and diverse, and contributing somehow to a mission of peace, I suppose. But also just, I'm in this place, I love this place, I love studying theatre. I wonder where that'll take me next. And for me at the time when I was studying, it actually took me to the Teze community in France, which is a religious community, ecumenical community set up during the war. And while I was there, there were a lot of Germans there, and I was kind of ready for a break. I wanted to practice my French. And there weren't many folk from France there, but there were a few Brits. And that was when I met my husband. He was one of the other few people who was there who was from the UK, and we ended up chatting. And long story short, a few years later, we ended up married, having stayed in touch. And I think, those are also the things on the journey where you end up in the place where you can make a life together and a home together. So I ended up very briefly living in Birmingham, with my husband, which I know is a connection to you, Kovido.
Where did you live in Birmingham?
I lived in Balsall Heath.
Oh, okay. I was from Solihull
Ah,
in the
right. Yeah.
southwest part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Know it well. Yeah. And and then, I got my PhD. I was applying for jobs because I wanted to teach in higher education. And we went where I got work, which was Glasgow, and I've been here ever since.
And
Just seeing
has
where
that been?
things take.
Have been teaching drama or teaching
So
language.
I was, I know. So my first job was in the German department. So I was teaching language and literature, but theatre mainly. So language and theatre studies, and also methodologies. So using anthropology as a method for studying German, which was quite a new thing to be doing at the time. Anthropologists did exotic stuff in the Pacific. And, German literature scholars tried to be like English literature scholars. And I was really wanting to kind of just break through that and use methods for saying, what would happen if we studied the life of people? And what would happen if we engage in it and reflect on it? And what comes if we think about the position we hold and the power we hold and the dimensions that were coming in from the Birmingham School at the time of race and gender and class? The work of Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall were influences on my PhD, but also on those early years of teaching. So really, the influence of the Birmingham School was important in cultural studies. But I was then thinking, well, what does it mean to think those questions with languages as well? And I'd always been interested in what moves people, so drama and theatre and the ritual roots of it, but also what moves people to visit theatres, particularly the small theatres I was in. So the local theatres, the what creates that domestic tourism almost, and that regular experience of coming to see your neighbour perform in amateur dramatics, and what is that, that cohesion that it produces in a society, and the way it brings people a story that is told in a community that enriches the community and that helps to integrate people in, and that the person you thought was just a guy.
I just wanted to say, I don't know if you know, but Brent is actually studying drama and what's it called?
Performing arts, yeah, at
Oh,
Otago
I forgot
University, and
about that.
he's in
Right.
about 10 plays a year. I've
Oh,
seen quite a few
really?
of them. He's an
Yeah.
amazing actor.
Thank you. You're very
So,
kind.
but you would be one of the people that everyone flocked to see in the theatres.
I don't know about that, but I've come to it very late. I've been an educationalist and most recently a school principal for the last 20 years.
Oh,
And
right.
into 2020, I pulled the pin and ended up doing a performing arts degree. So I'm doing honours at the moment.
Fantastic.
And yeah, just loving it.
Fantastic.
Loving it.
Oh, yeah. No. It's an amazing, there's an amazing liberation that comes on stage, I think. Just extraordinary. So yeah, so I suppose, that those questions were with me and they took me then to teach in quite an interdisciplinary way. So I taught in theatre studies, I taught in German, I taught in comparative literature, I did some work in anthropology. And then, as universities do, and I know this is also true in your own university, that you go through restructures, so your disciplines disappear and they emerge again somewhere else. And it's a highly traumatic experience. But actually, there are, you meet new friends and fellow travelers, and you fall into step and you start to write together or research together or plan together or you sit on a committee together, and that then opens new doors. So I suppose, I feel as though, half the time I just feel like I've gatecrashed an amazing party. Oh, how did I end up here? And in my team now, we have a bit of a joke, which is, we all say, oh, that's not in my job description. And there are all kinds of things that aren't in our job descriptions that we end up doing, which, it's always just means we're having a really exciting time. We weren't expecting to be do this. We don't think this is in our skill set, but we're learning something from it. So yeah, that's been a bit of a spirit, I suppose, and has then taken me into the themes of refugee work that have come through having looked at refugees and intercultural education and thinking with the city of Glasgow, the importance of that, the Civic University of Glasgow, really wanting us to think with that. That's taken me into other languages, other cultures, other places, and that's really then opened the work out worldwide. I mean, especially in the last 15 years of my career. So whilst in many ways the first half of my career was building up and out of European languages and intercultural programs and into methodological ideas and kind of opening out, then the last 15 years has been about how we make a difference to people's lives and how we can really use the resources, the rich resources of a university to do that
If
and
you
put it out.
if we think of sort of the history of Europe from November the 9th, 1989, when the wall came down, to sort of the Brexit era and global and economic refugees, the story of Britain, from my perspective growing up and the time I lived there, was there was so much immigration, and labor brought to the UK after the war, and and all the ripple effects that that caused, and then if more recent times, during the Brexit period, how UKIP sort of made that such a platform for winning the vote and shutting the borders and sort of in sync with, say, the views of the United States. And now we have a situation in Gaza where people are just being moved around. I guess in a very long way, I'm sort of saying, the focus seems to be getting drawn tighter and tighter and tighter to how we're treating and looking after people. And
Absolutely.
we're not doing it well.
So I think at state level we're clearly doing it very badly. Just before I came onto the call, I was in touch with a senior barrister who wanted me to know that South Africa has just instituted another set of proceedings against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And the document that they've just posted is extremely serious. The Global South are really very keen to make sure that the countries of the Global North, the allies of the State of Israel's actions in Palestine, are held to the same standard as other countries have been held to. So I was just looking at that and thinking, you know, on the one hand, we're in a really difficult situation. There's no doubt. And that much of what the West has put forward as its human rights agenda is unmasked as the absolute hypocrisy that it is and has been for a long time, where we are seeing quite clearly that human rights apply to the allies of the West and do not apply to those we decide we do not wish it to apply to. And that is absolutely revealing what we've long known, which is that the Security Council as a mechanism is not a mechanism for peace building, in many situations. So I think at that level, we are really seeing the fissures. Those always bring a hope with them. You know, whenever there's a crack, the light can get in.
Yeah.
But that does not make things good for the people caught up in the situation right now. And you know, in many ways, I think it's a little bit like that old that story of the wee boy who had a sign in, I think it was in East Timor, that he held up saying, "Stop the war." And, you know, the bombs are raining down, and, you know, our, you know, Hawk jets are flying over East Timor, and, you know, it, being part of that egregious set of actions. And somebody says, "You know, why are you holding that sign up? You know, you can't stop this war." And he said, "I'm trying to stop the next war from now." And in a way, what we're doing now isn't about, it is about this, absolutely about this, and it's about our colleagues and it's about solidarity, but it's also about the next war from now, and about how we uphold those international conventions that were laid down, how we commit to them, how we maintain them, how we revise them to be fit for purpose. So that said, you know, the kind of failures of the international system are there for all to see. But they're really only failures because certain states have decided not to uphold them. So that certain states have decided they're not binding, even though they are binding. So the order from the International Court of Justice, the provisional measures that were brought are binding on all parties to the Genocide Convention, as it's known in the shorthand, and they are unappealable. So whilst we do have governments like my own in the UK saying, this is unhelpful, that doesn't stop the fact that there are proceedings being taken out against our leaders to determine whether or not their decision to continue to supply arms to Israel makes them accessories to genocide, at which point they too, as third parties, will potentially face a day in the Hague. And, you know, this will be ongoing for the next 14 years at least, I would think. You know, Israel is on trial for genocide. There are many, many, many measures that need to be taken, many procedural stages to go through as to whether or not this comes to trial and what the final determination is. But right now we're in a situation where, thanks to the actions of the Global South and particularly South Africa, but other countries who have supported them, Israel is being held to the same standards as former Yugoslavia, with the Balkans and Srebrenica, as Rwanda, as Darfur, and as the places in the world where genocidal proceedings have been brought, and that these are deemed by the 15 judges, 15 of the 16, 17 judges at the International Court of Justice, to be serious enough conditions that have been described by the South African legal team to warrant the provisional measures that have been taken, which are very clear and very precise. So I take quite a lot of hope from The instruments of international justice at the moment, they are slow, they are painfully slow, they are too slow for the circumstances that my colleagues in Gaza find themselves in at the moment. But the other thing I take a lot of strength from is the strength of the solidarity movement, particularly from my Jewish colleagues and my Israeli colleagues, and they're not necessarily the same thing. One of the things when we talk about the conflict is we get our feet in the weeds almost with we don't know what we're talking about, and that can be used quite perniciously to kind of trip people up in debate. But we're talking about the category of people who are Jewish. We're talking about people who are Jewish ethnically, people who are Jewish by commitment of faith. We're talking about, and that may be through conversion or it may be through birth. We're talking about people who are citizens of the State of Israel, and there are many different dimensions there. We're talking about people who may be Arab Israeli within those contexts. So there's lots of different categories there, just as there are around people who are Muslim, people who are ethnically Arab, people who are Christian. So there's many different dimensions, all of which could make for really great circumstances for peace building, because there's lots of points of contact, but there's also at the moment lots of use of those po points of contact to say anybody who criticizes the State of Israel is committing anti-Semitism. And we can argue about whether that is true or not. There are ways in which it could be deemed to be true. But equally, and I'm seeing this a lot coming from my Jewish colleagues at the moment, from whom I take a lot of support, and their actions for peace in the world have been really quite inspiring, particularly those still in Israel who are protesting the actions, who are really saying it is an act of philo-Semitism to say to the people who are citizens, who are Jewish citizens of Israel, that we believe your security will not be met, and your fears that another Holocaust is just around the corner, which is what you have been brought up with, that this will not be met by perpetuating a plausible risk of genocide on the Palestinian people. And that, as always, and in every peace conflict situation we've known worldwide, peace can only be founded on justice. It needs agreements, it needs accords, and it needs us to be able to live again with our enemies. And that's the true security system. So I think for me at the moment, I take a great deal of hope from those movements of solidarity, from seeing the Jewish bloc marching with the others who are marching in the UK every single weekend, every single the hundreds of actions. Globally at the moment, I think the figures in the United States are 70% of people want a ceasefire. We've similar figures over here, and the energy and the actions and the concern is deep and palpable. And maybe just to say that I've never lived through anything like this, and I've been through the Tigray genocide, not in the state, but through it in the diaspora, or the genocidal conditions in Tigray. I mean, it's been deemed to be an ethnic cleansing. It may end up having a genocide case brought, but it's very difficult to get evidence out of Tigray at the moment. The current situation in Sudan is absolutely atrocious, with 8 million people displaced, and a possibility of ethnic cleansing and potential genocide that would need again to be brought as a case to the International Court of Justice. But it's Gaza that is the on everyone's mind, and I think I see people really, people are undone by it. People are lost for words. People are experiencing the structures of genocide that I've had to study a lot. The stages of genocide that you go through, the phases that we see, and are identifying those stages, but also seeing new stages that will mean we need to revise some of the work we've done, that the Lemkin Institute on Genocide has done, and others, to really look at, what I'm seeing at the moment at stage 10, which is denial. I'm now seeing denial being weaponized by the State of Israel and by its allies to really gaslight vast populations worldwide to say you can't protest, you can't speak, you can't do anything. And I think in those circumstances, we're needing to be quite careful and clever about how we act.
Sorry, I was just going to say, when I was teaching in the UK, one of my good friends was an Orthodox Jew called Abram Stern, and we've had a couple of conversations with him. He's currently living in Jerusalem, and they've been extremely challenging conversations because this podcast started purely out of our feeling of absolute powerlessness to assist and help people when we're 12,000 miles away from the situation. And Abram, when you speak to someone who has a lived experience of being an Israeli citizen who, while not backing the government's actions, is quite defensive
Of
around
course.
some of the things. And you, this is someone whom I love and respect, and it's extremely challenging. And the his point was, why aren't people marching on the streets about what's happening in Sudan? Why aren't people sort of taking the same attention? And I think you alluded to this earlier about how it seems that only some people are held to the high standards of humanity, and there's something wrong with the global system. And when I hear you talking about the international court and the things that are binding, it seems like the only consequence of anything like that is most people say, well, how does it get enforced, or what effect does the binding have? And
I mean, the
we would say it doesn't appear to be anything.
No, I mean, I think, I mean, I'm on the end of messages every single day from my colleagues and my partners in the Gaza Strip, who I have worked with for 15 years. At this moment in time, I know that we have lost over 200 members of families that I have, of colleagues that I've worked with and friends I've worked with. We are sustaining and containing levels of grief that I have never known anything like. And I'm well used to being around refugee contexts and well used to being in discussions with people and hearing testimony from people that is really very hard to hear, but necessary to hold. But this is of a whole other order. I really hear that point about, Israeli Jews saying, this is not fair that we're being held to this standard and others aren't. I think it's fair to say that, there have been so many rulings in the United Nations around the illegality of the occupation and particularly the siege of Gaza, and nothing has been done. That actually, the counter argument to that is that there has been impunity for Israel for many years, and that has been aided and abetted by the Allies and through the Security Council and through the veto, and that actually that wasn't the case in Rwanda, and that wasn't the case in Darfur, and it certainly wasn't the case in Tigray, and that was that's a conflict that nobody podcasts about or talks about or really knows very much about because the Ethiopian government refused to allow any reporting, any human rights observers, or anything at all. And there were no SIM cards and there were no ways of getting the information out because it wasn't an advanced country in a technological sense and in the way that certainly the Gaza Strip has been, because it's had to be, because the only way of breaking the siege has been through technology. So I think it's not really it's not comparing like with like. It's kind of like comparing oranges and apples in these contexts. These are countries that have been held to account and held to a high standard. And I've sat with Sudanese war generals who know that if they leave the country, they'll be in The Hague. And, they feel aggrieved. They don't believe that these things should have been brought to them. They're concerned. They, want to be able to also make their own defense. So I think if you are called before that court, you do want to make your defense. And, you don't see things in the same way. And I think I have a great deal of understanding and sympathy, having studied Germany for such a long time, for what the imprescriptible nature of the Holocaust was. This was a one-time only event. It was an industrial scale horror. It is very, very difficult to kill that many people. And an industrial process was produced. It was planned for a long time. And it took that particular form at that moment in history. And I suppose what I'm seeing happening, and what I've read all the evidence that's gone to the International Court of Justice, also to the International Criminal Court, the UN special rapporteurs. And I, whilst I'm not a lawyer, I read the law in these areas very closely. What I would say is that the testimony and the evidence that is in the 86-page document from South Africa that went to the International Court of Justice is really harrowing testimony. It's very powerful testimony, and it's very plausible testimony. And it has carried weight by 15 votes or 16 votes to 7 to 1 or 2 in the International Court of Justice. And that's all we've got. Now, once you've got a ruling at the ICJ, the Security Council, if it isn't vetoed, can decide to stop a genocide. It can decide to act, and there is one action that can be taken that will do that. There are a number of things that can go on, but there's one particular action that will do that, and that is putting troops on the ground as a peacekeeping force. It's what was done in Rwanda. It was what particularly was done, and we always think peacekeeping forces are, the great white allies, but they're not actually. There's an extraordinary book and story written about the role of the Ghanaian troops in and the peacekeeping force that went into Rwanda, and General Anidaho, who led that force. And when he was there, many of the other forces were saying it's too dangerous, we're pulling out. And he decided to stay and be the buffer zone that the peacekeeping force needs to be, to hold to a discipline and an order that takes away the kind of the literal madness that overtakes people in the frenzy of killing. It's almost like a frenzied, almost sexualized activity. People are out of control with what they're doing. And they've taken leave of their senses in these circumstances. They are not acting like people who are abiding by normal rules. And we're seeing this with some of the images from the
In
IDF soldiers with
Gaza,
the lingerie in Gaza, for example. And we see this, but in also other ways. The rules of war are set aside, and things are done which need to be brought to justice for peace to be possible. And General Anidaho, he famously, when people were saying we need to go home, we need to go back to our families, we need to pull out, he said to every single one of his troops, he said, come into my office and make the case, and make the case why your life is more important than the life of the Rwandans here. And so people had to come in, and they had to argue the case and say why they wanted to go back and why their family mattered more on the planet than somebody else's. And they stayed, and they saved thousands of lives. And the story of that was written up by Kofi Anidaho and General Anidaho. So Kofi Anidaho was General Anidaho's brother, who was in New York at the time, who got messages through by telegram and pieced together the story. And in the book Guns Over Kigali, we read this really moving story of this extraordinary courage. I find it really hard to say that all we've got is a military peacekeeping force, because I'd like there not to be a military solution. And I think we're at the stage at the moment where, we're beginning to see mobilization around sanctions, around the possibility of a boycott. Those are things that I think are possible, but these are elements that, yeah, maybe can bring us to a different place.
We call our podcast The Caravan of Hope. And when I listen to you talk, Alison, I hear that you have got some hope and faith in humanity that we can get to a place where something could happen. Could you maybe talk about if you were sort of able to create the conditions whereby a peace and a solution was possible? What do you think it would take for us to get to that place?
So I don't think it's a future place. I think it's present with us now. And it's something that I see every day, both in the conversations I have with my Israeli colleagues as they struggle, but also as I see it every single day with the messages I receive from the Gaza Strip. So we've gone through this five times in the time that I've been working, the last 15 years that I've been working with the Islamic University of Gaza, Al-Aqsa University in the Gaza Strip, and been working with colleagues on peace building projects in Gaza around languages and arts in particular, and education, and around gender-based violence. And each time we go through it, you know, we message each other. There's a WhatsApp line. We check in. We ask how they are. We lobby our politicians. We've got a kind of drill that we go through, a kind of peace drill that we go through, which is, you know, questions will be raised in Parliament by our MPs. You know, we write letters. We engage. We make sure we stay in contact. We look and see if there's scholarships or ways of bringing people out. We lobby for peace as quickly as possible, and it usually dies down relatively quickly. And you know, my time in the Gaza Strip, you know, I was there when there was a series of bombings, and they were, you know, they were both frightening, but also they showed me the solidarity of the people in Gaza and how hard they work at keeping people safe. What we're seeing this time around, and which is why I'm seeing a very different set of circumstances to the previous five aggressions on the strip that I've seen, is that we've moved through the last 3 months into a place where we don't talk about what's happening any longer with our colleagues in Gaza. And always our work has been about doing the work, not about talking about the siege or the conflict. You know, it's about doing the work because that dignifies people. That gives people hope. That is where people draw their resource. That's the mahi, if you like, that people are doing. So that's what you affirm. And by doing it, you create the you're already living the peace. And you're defying the war, and you're defying the violence, and you're saying, you may be doing all these things to me, but I still am speaking peace in this context. So what I'm seeing now, and it's been really quite an extraordinary experience over the last few months, is that my colleagues are, they write to me in the morning and they write to me in the evening when we aren't on a lockdown of the internet. And they write with the words of peace. So every morning, you know, I'm just looking at the latest, you know, my colleague writing to me, and he says, "Salam all times to the peace light that never sets in East and West." And I reply and I say, "Salam from Glasgow's night to Gaza's night, peace to each sleeping moment." And in the morning and in the evening, in very different ways, we for months now, this is the idiom of peace that we are practicing. And we're doing it for a number of reasons. One is that the families of during genocide, family and ethnic cleansing, families all sleep together because then they die together. And when they've no hope of protecting people in other ways, because the bomb will land on the house and everyone will be killed. So, I mean, I'm speaking with colleagues who've lost 21 members of their family, 19 members of their family, 42 members of their family, and they might be the only survivor. So in sharing these words with me morning and evening, they know that somebody is curating and containing their last words. And that they can trust that I will take that forward and I will write the obituaries. You know, so Rifat Al-Awliya, the Palestinian poet, who was assassinated He was one of my colleagues. He worked on one of my peace building projects. He developed a program of Arabic short storytelling and English language storytelling with women to help their children survive the regular aggressions and bombings. And, you know, he wrote the most extraordinary poem and he wrote the most extraordinary words to us. And some of them were very hard and hard to hear and hard to take. And some of them were very challenging. But, you know, when he died, we were able to be one of the places of obituary and of honoring what he had said and the words that he'd left with us. And we all continue to do that in his memory. And we're kind of almost doing palliative work as colleagues with our colleagues in the Gaza Strip by holding and collecting these words. And after the ICJ had ruled, and when governments decided to cut the funding to UNRWA based on unsubstantiated claims made in a dossier sent by Israel, that led UNRWA and Philip Lazzarini to take the unprecedented step of suspending the people against whom the allegations had been made, and terminating their contracts before the full investigation had been held. So really setting aside all UN protocol and good employment protocol, but because it's so critical that the aid gets into Gaza and UNRWA are the dominant producer and the one partner who can really make this possible. Because all that happened, I began a practice of writing what I thought were prayers or intercessions or maybe petitions or curses or woes or incantations, spells. I don't quite know what they were, but they were on my social media feed. But every single day since then, I've woken up and I have written a prayer that is an honest and spare request of humanity, of our maker. I don't really care who you believe in as a greater power of inducement of hope. You know, for me, it's still a liberatory Christian God in one way or another that is incarnate with amongst us, that dwells amongst us, not a transcendent figure. But, you know, I'm seeing then my Palestinian colleagues are replying. They're replying to what my pleas are in this sequence of prayers. And, you know, I'm about to publish a sequence of 30 of them. They're called Call and No Response. And they are places where I'm finding I'm able to be honest about what I'm doing and what I'm seeing, and their prayers for these genocidal days. And, you know, so maybe just to give you a couple of examples of these, there's one. There was an action taken on Brighton Beach where they took the number of children killed and they laid out children's clothes for each body, laid them out on the beach. You might have seen it. And so it was extraordinary, an extraordinary action. So this on that day when I saw this, I just said, bless the hands that lay out children's clothes because there is no one to lay out their bodies. Bless the sand and sea of shores that take us beyond territory. Bless those who refuse to be defined by death and write to me from hell on earth of dawn, of sunrise, of stars. And so these are kind of very short, very spare pieces that are there to really, yeah, just to name what is happening. And I'm inspired in this by the work of Viktor Klemperer, who wrote a journal through National Socialism in Germany, where he wrote down observations about language and what people were doing. And this is my short way of doing it. And I, you know, here's another one that just came from all the blockades around the aid trucks, you know. So for the 1,000 drivers of 1,000 aid trucks prevented from entering, honor. For the tens of thousands who take to the streets to protest for peace, thanks. For the hundreds of thousands who don't do anything, a profound pity. And for the few in power who vote to keep sending arms, we beg you to stop. And that then brought a reply from one of my Palestinian colleagues who then just said, you know, out of an anger, for the MPs gaslighting the public and playing victims, shame. For those playing with rules and twisting protocols, shame. For those refusing to stop sending arms, shame. So there's a kind of a place there where each day, almost like we're waking up to your daily morning prayers, I suppose for me, that's what I'm doing, and that's what it's become, and this is my space of intercession.
It's beautiful. Yeah, we're very touched.
Yeah. And it's just a way of, you know, holding my, you know, I don't, you know, quite a lot of people are saying to me, I need to detox, I need to cut off, I can't see the media, it's too distressing. I really understand that. I cannot put it down. Yeah, I am too bound in to the care and to the journey that I'm in of being part of refugee journeys and stories that I have no choice. You know, this isn't about this is about you know, I'm in this, you know, come what may, I'm alongside these people in this struggle. I'm trying to hold a space for vigil, a space where we might be adjacent to one another, where we don't agree, but where we might hold a space of critical vigilance and critical vigil that is the space where we create hope. And that for many, that is born out of petition and prayer, and petition as prayer or petition as a political action. But that word petition, which carries that word pity within it, I think is a really powerful word for me. And it's one that I've really needed to hold on to try and produce a sense of hope. And I see, so that hope I see, you know, my colleagues in Gaza, when we had that very brief ceasefire, you know, I was messaging and saying, you know, I really hope you have a day that is good. And they said, yes, we are going to, you know, we're going to get the olive harvest. We're going to pick the olives. It's a little bit late, but we're going to pick the olives. And then they queued for 24 hours to press the oil. And then they distributed it to all the displaced people from the north where they were living. And so you see this, you know, the goodness at the heart of humanity that is, you know, greater than all that is wrong. And that you see that in the worst of times. And I, you know, I was talking recently with friends saying, you know, corresponding with my Gaza colleagues at the moment is like corresponding with Viktor Frankl in the camps and after. Yeah. It is, you know, these people who are still in the sunrise and the sunset, in the joy of a message on a phone in a morning that tells you somebody is caring for you elsewhere, and there's somebody to turn to who will try. And, you know, that there's somebody who'll tell you, yep, that question, we asked it in Parliament and here it is. And you can hear it if you click on the link. There's something about that work of solidarity that is quite, it is quite an extraordinary thing, I think, that we don't easily know when we are not people who have gone through these circumstances, what that level of solidarity means, that you're not on your own. And that you know someone cares.
Yeah, I think it's because we go on the marches every week, you know, and, you know, the main reason is there to be, you know, with solidarity with the Palestinian people there to say, you know, we care about what's happening and we care about you and, you know, to hold hope, really, help them hold hope because that's what they're doing to their relatives.
Yeah. And I mean, for years I've known whenever there's been aggression on the Gaza Strip, you know, the peace demonstrations and the vigils, we've taken photographs, we've shown, you know, the football clubs in Glasgow are legendary for the messages that they send out to the world from their matches, just calling for peace and calling for an occupation. And we know that when those arrive, you know, it goes everywhere. I mean, it brings a hope, it brings a possibility. So no wonder there are forces wanting to shut us down. No wonder there are those who are trying to say, no, you can't speak, you're anti-Semitic in what you're saying when you call for a ceasefire. And we're needing to use legal routes to protect ourselves. So Just in the last
Yes.
few weeks, we've three academics at the in Britain who have been successful in libel claims, or in defamation claims, or in wrongful dismissal claims within the UK, who have been reinstated or who have had damages paid to them, because we actually do know our, the law is on our side in this, and it may be our government yet again tries to change the law as it is doing with the Rwanda bill at the moment to say, a country that, the Supreme Court has ruled for refoulement of refugees, the UK Parliament are basically trying to make a decision to say it is safe because we say it is. They might do that. We may have to take this a long, long way down the road. It may be far more than just trolling on social media that we have to deal with. And needing to do the hard work of analysis that keeps us safe. But I think there are things we've learned from the work we've been doing that are helpful to us, and that, if we respect law, if we tell the truth, if we use the academic freedom we have, if we sift the evidence, if we don't demonize individuals, but actually look at the processes. If we speak of what it is that the state of Israel is undertaking now, not that has always been the case, which would, I think, be anti-Semitic in that case. But if we say right now there are decisions taken by this regime that are producing untold misery for a people, then we have a way of looking at it, and that has to be countered with the human rights abuses that were committed, yes, on the 7th of October, but also by resistance forces in other places. I have a dear friend who was blown up by a suicide bomber in Jerusalem a few years ago when she was in Jerusalem. And we live in this conflict zone where we lose people, and we have to try and think, not how do we stay in the pain of the past and only ever inculcate that into ourselves and our imaginaries, but how do we do what my colleagues in Gaza are doing with me at the moment and bring these words of blessing and bring these words of hope, that are ones that we might be able to, might be able to build a future with. Because if we practice it daily, peace is a practice. It's not an event, it's not a declaration, it's not a signature on a piece of paper. It's not a neoliberal agreement that makes the middle classes rich. It's not one of those. It's something we have to practice every day, along with the practices of conflict transformation. And some of those are really basic to just saying, we will say these words.
Alison, I realize it's probably getting very late where you are, and we've had a very wide-ranging conversation. I do know that when we started this podcast, it's something that Kovido felt very strongly about was the role of women in government and in being able to be more peace orientated than many of the male politicians and leaders that we have. And I noticed on a bio I was reading of yours about the CUSP project. We're looking at cultures of sustainable peace, and there's goals that relate to empowering women and girls. And I kind of thought, I think that's where Kovido is coming from in terms of, the voices of women seem to be drowned out with a lot of saber rattling, whereas if women were given a greater voice, perhaps we wouldn't be in as much conflict as we appear to be. Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, I mean, that's my thought, is that the women would kind of go, well, actually, yes, I don't want my son to die or my daughter to die, or and I don't want your son or daughter to die either. There's more empathy.
I mean, most of the literature around peace building will point to the absolutely fundamental role of women in peace building and women's ability to work in a collective and work in partnership and, be creative and think around things and solve problems and juggle all of those, things that have come from the traditional roles that women perform around the world and have done, and also which have come out of the, the solidarity work of international feminism. I think that is true. I mean, I would say that, my experience of a woman prime minister growing up was much more of someone keen to saber rattle and, invade the Falkland Islands, and, wasn't a great role model, but equally, maybe the exception play, proves the rule. And there is, there is a steadiness in a number of the political leaders. But I tend to look much more, I'm really interested in that meso level of women as leaders within society, and particularly with the CUSP project within within cultural institutions. What is it about the way that we lead cultural institutions and places of collecting? I've just come into you from this wonderful restaurant in town run by two Eritrean women who set it up to be, a place where, the single young men from Eritrea, who are the predominant refugees in the city, could have a sort of home-like environment. But now it's a home for many different types of people, and, all walks of life will find themselves there. And I'd gone there with a woman from Ukraine who'd been wanting to interview me and speak to me. And so I was in this lovely situation where, the woman from Ukraine had obviously never experienced anything like this. She comes from a context where there's been a great deal of racism towards particularly Black and ethnic minority people from the African continent. And so, her sitting down with me to talk about, the rebuilding efforts that might come in Ukraine in an Eritrean restaurant, being waited on hand and foot by these two glorious women making her tea and coffee. And I just thought, this is where it begins. This is where we make peace. This is how we make peace. This is, it's the Joy Harjo poem about, peace is made at the kitchen table. I don't know if you know that poem. It's a fabulous poem.
If you could send us a link, that'd be great.
I will indeed. I will send you the link. It's just, called Perhaps the World Ends Here. The world begins at a kitchen table, no matter what, we must eat to live. And it goes through all the ways in which, we live at the kitchen table. It's a glorious poem. But I think it's one which to my mind is emblematic of the work that has to be ordinary, and that peacemaking shouldn't be seen as work which needs some kind of special qualification. Adrienne Rich talks about no extraordinary power, but actually it's what we do in families, it's what we do in communities, it's what we do in, institutions, it's what we do in English language clubs, it's what we try and do in churches, usually really badly, but when we put an intention on ourselves for it, and it begins, as Rowan Williams says, it begins with meeting, greeting, and eating. That's what neighborliness is, that's the social bond, that's where peace happens, and we make it by making it. We make the road by walking, not by academic theoretical discussions about what it might look like if it was perfect, but actually the real mess of kids teething on a table and people not being able to understand each other, but still bringing a cup of coffee and some popcorn for a Ukrainian woman who's going, "What is this?" And that surprise and that joy and that possibility and that encounter with difference that is overcome. Those are the ways that we move things forward.
And I wanted to ask one last question, which is about, because you're linked with Eritrea, you're saying most refugees in Glasgow are from Eritrea, which is, I don't think there'd be
Many.
maybe one or two in Dunedin. Others are mainly from
Yeah.
Syria or Iraq, Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Dunedin, those were the groups certainly that I was meeting. Some Palestinians as well. Yeah, definitely. Quite a lot of it. I mean, people move along love lines when they can, or with their families if they can. And so, the the connections that were in my grandfather's backgrounds from the Indian subcontinent. They bring people, the connections from the empire, they and the Commonwealth, they bring people. Language is something that people have a commonality with the education system. But then a number of other Eritreans, Eritreans, there are many Eritreans worldwide who are refugees, and my own family is a family of Eritrean refugees as well. So it's a part of the world I have come to. Well, not Eritrea. I don't know Eritrea. I can't enter Eritrea, but I know the culture and the traditions of that country these days. Have a role to inhabit as a woman within that culture, as a grandmother, as an abai, as I'm called, as a mother, as a foster mother in that context as well.
How did that happen?
We used to volunteer to take folk in. I mean, it's something that people have done, with Syrian and since with Ukrainian refugees. But in the days before it was trendy, there was a small, slightly crazy group of us that just said we would have a circle for people who were destitute and were seeking asylum in the city, and they would come and stay with us until they regularized their status. And so, maybe five or six families did this, and one of the people who ended up coming to stay with us through the charity we worked with was our daughter Rima. And she came, and 15 years later, we've got three beautiful grandchildren. One very born, he's 6 weeks old.
Congratulations.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. Oh, that's lovely.
And I it's a bit like I said, I didn't plan this. I didn't plan to have an Eritrean daughter. I didn't plan to have Eri Scott, as she calls them, grandchildren. I didn't plan to be somebody who fostered. I didn't plan, it just happened to me there. It was on the doorstep in front of me and kind of needed to happen. So,
That's a wonderful story.
well, look, Alison, it's just been inspiring just to talk to you and hear about your journey and your messages of hope, I think, because I guess sometimes we can feel that we have a bit of gloom and doom. So, and it's lovely to hear and be reminded that, yeah, we shouldn't give up hope and that we should do all that we can. And lovely that we've made that connection between Auchtiputi, Dunedin, the Edinburgh of the South, and Glasgow in the North. And
Indeed.
we really greatly value your time.
Thank you very much. And I'm really hoping to be back later this year. I'm hoping to come over in November, so it'd be really nice opportunity to maybe meet the caravan of in person.
That would be lovely. Okay, so thank you to our very special guest, Alison Phipps. And so from me, Brent Caldwell,
And me, COVID-O-matic.
may you be well, may you be happy, may you live with ease.
And may all beings be living in peace.
Gonna take a lot of love. We won't.